The Jodcast, Culling the Herd, with Naomi Asabra Frimpong, Monique Henson, Jake Morgan, Benjamin Shaw, and Charlie Walker. The Jodcast, Blue Dot 2017 Special Edition Mark II.
Hello everyone, and welcome to the Jodcast. I'm Charlie, and joining me in the studio are three people today. So we've got Ben.
Hello.
And we've got Naomi.
Hi.
And we've got Jake.
Hi.
So in the show this time, we're going to be taking you on our second Whistle Stop tour of the Blue Dot Festival, which took place in the summer at Jodrell Bank Observatory. We talked to John Spooner about how he hacked his way into space, Grant Munro about the hidden heroes of astronomy, and Amy Vinson about mitochondrial disorders. But first, before all of that, Monique interviews Beth Rogers about sun worshippers and lunatics.
I'm here with Beth Rogers from Guerrilla Archaeology at the Blue Dot Festival. So Beth, could you tell us a little bit more about what Guerrilla Archaeology is and what you're doing here at the festival?
Okay, so Guerrilla Archaeology is a branch from the Department of Cardiff University. A couple of lecturers got together and decided that probably it was a better idea to try and get the public more involved. So we go around different festivals, we try to do sort of interactive activities with different themes. We did a theme a couple of weeks ago, which was bog bodies, and the theme today is sun worshippers and lunatics. Very strong focus on the Bronze Age, but also at how they interpreted their relationship with the sun and the moon. I've got a couple of examples. So I've got the Nebrasky disc, and it's a large bronze plate, and it's got a gold inlay. It's about the size of like a large dinner plate, and it's got a couple of odd shapes on it. We think the central shape, two shapes. One is a crescent moon and one is a full moon. Some people like to argue that the full moon is more a sun, but because the bronze has been deliberately sort of darkened and the other shapes around it may be stars, we'd like to interpret that it's all moons. So around those shapes are lots of little dots, which are all sort of random. But there are seven that are in a constellation, and they're the seven sisters. This was very important because it told farmers at which point they should harvest their crops or sow their crops. So they used it as like a sign each time it appeared in the sky that this is what they were supposed to do and it was okay to continue. And then at the bottom of this disc is a sort of another crescent, kind of like a banana shape. And we believe this might be a boat. So they kind of had this idea that maybe the sun went under the earth at night, was extinguished and carried by a boat, brought round, and then was reignited or sort of came back to life for dawn. That was carried by a boat. And then we have other examples, which was sun chariots, which was also made from bronze and gold. These are all sort of 3,500 years old, and they were deliberately buried and they were deliberately sort of damaged. So maybe there was a ritual going on to try and sort of capture the magic. We like to say that maybe these images were made because a lot of them were made in Northern Europe where they had shorter days in the winter. Maybe this was their way of asking the sun to come back up so that they could have more hours so that their crops could be healthier and better and that kind of idea. But they may have just been making it because it passed the time of day. Obviously, no internet, no Wi-Fi. There wasn't much else that they could do, really. But the pieces of art are amazing. And there's obviously been so much work put into them. Like the Trondhjelm Sky Chariot is an exact replica of an original one. And the gold disc on it has been like lovingly decorated with sort of circles and squiggles. And maybe that's the idea of the sun at midday, or like at its brightest point. But the back of the disc hasn't been decorated, so maybe it's an interpretation of day and night and that kind of thing. So
that's really interesting how these like pieces can tell you about people's relationship with the sun and the moon, and like especially as astronomy is such a old part of human culture, actually. It's fascinating you can get such insights from, you know, one or two pieces.
There's also like the hats. These are hats sort of we're not really sure what the material was inside, but outside of it is gold that's been hammered into shape. They've been found in Germany as well. They're also Bronze Age. And none of them are found in the same area. So it suggests that people are travelling around and suggesting how's the best way to show off either wealth. We think maybe priests wore them. So they were trying to sort of show off how clever they were. The discs on them are quite interesting because they're supposedly a calendar.
Oh, wow.
But there's some sort of formula you can do where you mm-hmm. add up some of the circles and then divide by a number, and it's supposed to give you a certain number which you can sort of associate with the point mm-hmm. of the moon and what is it supposed to look like. So it was all kind of educational, and if priests wore it, they could say that they could predict the future. And
that's fascinating. And also, I should describe these as well, because I did not know, so there's some models of them here, I did not know that these were meant to be hats at all, because they're kind of tall and thin. I mean, this one I've got in front of me is possibly about half my height, but it's quite narrow, so about the size of my hand, width
these
of my
are
head.
Two size. We made them two
these
size.
Are two size, which is mm-hmm. just bizarre. Like, yeah. they aren't even. And then they've got going round them in, they've got circles repeated all the way around and layers all the way up, so which is what she was talking about in terms of using them to tell the yeah. date and the time, that kind of thing. They are, frankly, bizarre.
They
I don't
they actually survived almost in this state, so you can see the images. They literally survived like this because they were lovingly filled with soil before they were buried in the hope that the shape would stay, and made sure that the tops of them pointed up to the sky still, even though they were in the earth. There was definitely a ritual going on whilst they buried them. They're just very strange.
Yeah.
But they're absolutely amazing. Like, beautiful, so...
No, that's absolutely fascinating. So you were saying that guerrilla archaeology goes to lots of different festivals. What kind of other things have you also run?
So they're about to go to Wilderness. They did Luna last year. They've just been to Glastonbury as well. And then there's the Green Man Settlers Festival also. And we'll be at all of them. We've got different themes. So like I mentioned, we did bog bodies. Mm-hmm. And we were talking about hair and makeup and how they changed their skin. So tattoos. Because bog bodies and people who are frozen are the only people that we can find that still have hair. So we can learn hairstyles from them. So it turns out like certain knots for men meant that they were better in combat or whatever. You know how we expect men to have shorter hair nowadays? Well, no, they were supposed to have really long hair so they could show off all their elaborate styles. And then we also spoke about ochre and how they would decorate their faces. We spoke also about tattoos, because some of them survived and some of the Icemen, so like Ötzi, it looked like some of his tattoos were on places where he had osteoporosis, so maybe he was trying to do it as like a healing process, or maybe there was just a sort of a map of where he'd been, because he had obviously travelled a lot.
Who is Ötzi?
Oh, he was an Iceman. He was found up in the Alps. And 5,000 years old, I believe.
Wow.
Yes. And he was buried almost like... He sort of buried himself ritualistically. So he laid out all his weapons around him. And he was perfectly preserved. So.
Wow, that sounds like a gold mine for an archaeologist.
Exactly what we wanted when we found that. And there's a couple of others around the world. But they're not commonly found. Mm. So... we're trying to make all these assumptions from very small pieces of information about the civilizations that were really quite large. Mm-hmm. So we like to try and throw information at people and see if they can bounce back and say, well, what do you think? And we can stand there and go, yeah, maybe that's a one way to interpret it. But this is the reason why we think it.
No, I love that. And I love that you see public engagement as this two-way process rather than just scientists kind of going, here is what we know. It's you know, you also take something away from it.
Yeah, absolutely. We're always wanting to get information back. So some of the things like the sky chariot, mm-hmm. the idea of pulling the sun across the sky and back under the earth, that can be found in Egyptology, that can find Greek mythology, Roman mythology. And so many people know more about that kind of civilizations. We like to have some more information bounce back at us. So.
Yeah, that's fantastic. Well, thank you for talking to us at the Jodcast today. I hope you enjoy the rest of the festival.
Thank you very much.
Thanks for that, Monique. Next, we have John Spooner from the Unlimited Space Agency on how he hacked his way into space.
Hi, I'm here with John Spooner, the Artistic Director of Unlimited Theatre and the Director of Human Spaceflight at the Unlimited Space Agency. Welcome to the Jodcast.
Hi, Monique. Thanks very much for having me. We're here in my capacity as Director of Human Spaceflight Operations for the Unlimited Space Agency, which is the space agency that I accidentally set up about 7 years ago. We were writing a play. We'd been commissioned to write a play for children, all about science, because my theatre company, Unlimited Theatre, specialises in collaborating with working with scientists. So we've worked with quantum physicists, with neuroscientists. And then for this show, we wanted to make a show about space, because I really like space. And it's a great way of unlocking an interest in then lots of other science for young people in particular. But, you know, there's a lot of adults that like space as well. And in the course of making that show, the scientists that we met researched the subject with. The play was called Mission to Mars, so we were looking at human spaceflight missions. We met some really cool people, in particular including one woman called Gail Iles, Dr. Gail Iles, Dr. Awesome as she prefers to be called, who at the time was working as an astronaut instructor at the European Astronaut Centre in Cologne in Germany. She's a condensed matter physicist. I have no idea what that actually is, but she's very cool. And she invited us out to train with her for 3 days as astronauts at the Astronaut Centre. And that was really the start of my adventure in terms of then wanting to try and actually get to space. It was at the same time that Tim Peake had just joined the European Space Agency. We met him when we were out there doing that research. I was dancing inside the mock-ups of the International Space Station that they used to train the astronauts in. Tim was there at the time. In fact, all that group of astronauts that had just been recruited, so Luca Parmitano, Samantha Cristoforetti, they were all there. It was very cool, you know, seeing them train in the neutral buoyancy facility and just being really cool and astronauty. But we kept in touch with Tim. Then as we made more projects through the space agency that we had accidentally set up by starting this space agency, Tim continued to support. He's the patron of the space agency now, helping us to both promote, but also he's been really great at being really actively involved with a lot of the activities that we organise. So it's all about live performance, interaction, using game design and storytelling to engage young people with science. And then working with lots of other very cool scientists to make up those missions. And we're here with the space shed. It's modelled on my actual shed, my garden shed that I make up and write all my stories in at home. We've built one here. It's a bit whiz-bang. We've got smoke and lights and video and set, massive PA inside it. And that's where we tell the story from. And we've got lots of agents, like thousands and thousands of children that are members of the space agency. And they've seen the films that we make and put on YouTube, which are all based in the space shed. I think it's very special for all of me in particular, that there is now an actual space shed that we can tour to all the festivals and tell those stories in.
So you said this all started when you went off to the European Space Agency and you spent 3 days training there as well. What was that like?
And it was really, really exciting. It wasn't something that I'd expected to happen at all. So I'm an artist, I'm a writer and a theatre director, but I really, really love working with scientists in particular, just because there's so much interesting stuff that's happening and I get to learn a huge amount. And then if I can do, you know, a part of a job which is helping to communicate some of those really exciting ideas from the leading areas of research, but also increasingly looking at how can we as artists maybe feed into help with areas, aspects of that research, not in technical ways probably, but certainly in ways of bringing audiences to increasing an understanding of it at early stages in the development of those things, so that the researchers can have some feedback and useful responses that might actually influence the research in positive ways, but also ask questions that might not otherwise get asked. Going out to train as an astronaut was a very practical way of finding out what it is to try and get in space. And actually, beyond just being really excited because, you know, the kit is cool, the people are cool, it was really revelatory, I guess, understanding how seriously everyone takes it, actually. How everyone says, you know, going to space is difficult. And, you know, famously, I think it was Gene Cernan and the Apollo missions were like, there is no room for error. If you fail, people die. You know, it is life and death when it comes to human space flight. But even if you're just launching uncrewed space vehicles, satellites, you've still got, you know, that is a hugely expensive thing to go wrong if it does. Beyond the fun of it, also developing a really deep respect for all of the people that are working inside it. And then finding who the fun people are as well. So like Tim is really fun. Gail, really fun. There are some people that are not quite as fun. But it's like, that's okay, because we found the fun people.
That sounds fascinating. With your space shed, you tell that story of how you hacked into space. Obviously, I don't want to spoil your story for anyone who sees it later on, but could you just give us a brief overview of that?
There's inevitably spoilers. So here's the spoiler alert. If you're planning on coming see How I Hacked My Way to Space, which is the show, then this is the spoiler alert for you. Telling stories is a very powerful thing, and not just for children, but for all of us. It's how we explain and describe the world to ourselves, you know, and science does that really well. And if you can tell the story really well about what it is that you're doing, why it's important to people, then people get really excited about it. My job is telling stories. You know, that's the thing that I've spent 20 years learning how to do and developing how to do. That's my area of research. I like to think of it as the last 7 years have been an ongoing piece of performance art for me, where I basically go around saying I'm the director of human spaceflight operations for my own space agency. Some people are annoyed by that. They're the less fun people that are really serious about their work, that think that I'm not taking it seriously. And I am. But I'm just, you know, being playful as well, because that's a good way to engage people. But you always find, like I say, those fun people, and they will come on that journey with you. And the fun people, it's how you get great ideas. Then developed me saying this and being invited to places, including NASA run a global space apps challenge, which, because they have a huge amount of data, they have a huge amount of stuff, but a limited amount of resource in order to process that. So they go, these are the problems we're currently facing in areas of human spaceflight. How can you as hackers come together and maybe solve some of these problems? I went along to a couple of these events. My problem is that, you know, I really want to go to space, but I don't have any way of getting there. So the first one I went along to, I said, you know, my mission is to hack my way into space in the next 24 hours. One of the guys, there are people that go, well, you're just a nutter. And other people that go, oh, come over here, I've got an idea. And we built a team that miniaturized me, scanned me, 3D printed me, put me on at that stage. So over the years, we've sort of made the story. First, it was just helium-filled party balloons. And then the Met Office, we worked with them to do a high-altitude balloon launch. At some stage, we won a prize through those hackathon events. We won a global prize for best mission concept for a spacesuit that we designed, a connected, internet-connected spacesuit that we designed for Tim. And again, this one where Tim was really great. He Skyped in, he spoke to all the people that were working on the team designing it, so we could really customize it for him. The prize was to go to a rocket launch at Cape Canaveral, which was really cool, again. While I was out there, I hooked up with Tim, because he lives in America. I asked him if, you know, I've got this minifig of me, would you take him with you when you go to space, because he'd been confirmed to fly to the ISS by this stage. And he said yes, he took him with him in his personal kit. And so, you know, that I tell the story of how I hacked my own space, and part of that is the story of, you know, how it's not always plain sailing. Going to space is difficult, and you encounter all those problems and how you have to deal with them.
And I think that's such a great story as well, because you showed how you went through like lots of different agencies and stuff, like trying different things, and eventually you got there through a route you may not have expected. I saw a bit of your show yesterday, and the kids absolutely loved it as well.
We just had a family come up, actually, and the parents were like, that was great, you know, that's so good for adults as well as for the kids. And I was like, well, great, yeah, that's because that's, you're our audience. It's like, I want to make work, because I've got children, two boys of my own, they're 13 and 11 now, but that's part of the reason why I started making work for families, wanting to make stuff that we can go to and do and experience as a family. And if you've got a good story and you can tell it well, then that's for everyone. So
you were saying that you have really striven to make something that appeals to both kids and their parents. It was a whole family experience. Has that changed your approach in any way, or is there anything that you've taken from that that you didn't expect to?
It's a tonal thing. It's a weird tone that some people, when they're making work or projects for young audiences, take with them, and it's not something I've ever bought into or really enjoyed. I've always spoken to my own children in a way that I feel is very respectful of their abilities to take on board stuff, and sometimes they think I'm weird. You have to find that tone that is appealing to a lot of people, and not underestimate your audience is the thing as well. And you know, they'll ask you the questions, and those young audiences are the ones that will definitely ask you the tough questions while you're trying to do the thing. And I think it's really important that there is stuff and things that you can do together, that you can all enjoy, that you can go away from and have a conversation about together, rather than, and this was my experience when my kids were very young, have to have a four-year-old really excited about going to the immersive Bob the Builder experience, and all the time me to be inside my head trying to get to my happy place while this is happening. And the kids didn't even think that much of it, because it was like a working model of capitalism in its purest form. And the whole exit through the gift shop thing was just this really intense experience. And I did think at that point, I'm going to have to do it myself. I'm going to have to make some stuff that I can do with my kids and that other people can come and do with their kids. And if it's in the process, then unlocking an interest in things, subjects that they are going to then go on and pursue a little bit more. So our job is to inspire them. We work with a lot of people to then do follow-up activities that really allow people to go deeper into the subjects. We've got an app. It's free. It's a free app that has been funded by the UK Space Agency, by the Paul Hamlin Foundation. It's a really fun app where basically you sign up as an agent of the Unlimited Space Agency, you create an avatar, and then then you go on missions. We've made films in the space sheds, and each time you complete a mission, which has been co-designed with one of the partners, we've got the Royal Observatory, our place in space, then the Met Office, we do space weather, European Space Agency about fitness and nutrition and how that works in space, coding in there with Young Rewired, the Science Museum, how to launch and build rockets. Inside there, it's all curriculum linked. It's there if you need it as a teacher in a school. Also, a lot of people that are home educating their kids, and also now increasingly, just people that really want to do the missions because they get badges, they're endorsed by those people as well. So they got a badge from not just us, but from the Science Museum as well. And every time they complete an mission, they unlock the next episode in the films. And the films feature Tim as well, and we animate Mini-Me, Mini-John. He's one of the characters in there. It's about making it really fun and also investing a lot of work and thought and time into it to make it really good. The big thing in there for me is helping those young people understand how these subjects apply to their lives. And the big challenge that you see people in working in education is that children are demotivated because they don't understand how this subject applies to their life. Why am I studying this? This has no meaning in my life. I think space is a great way of being able to go, if you do this, then you can go here. The broad thing, anyone here wants to go to space? Yes. Do science. That's how you get to space.
That's a great message. And it's true, actually, as well. And I think a lot of people don't realise that even if you don't get, because very few people get into space, yeah, but thousands of people work in space-related activities. Never realised how big the space industry is in the UK. It's absolutely massive. What you're doing, getting kids interested, but also the parents. So often I speak to parents and they go, oh, my son loves this, but I don't understand anything. What you're doing kind of bridges that gap a little bit because it brings them into it.
Absolutely. And it's about doing it together so that you do have that shared thing. And I think that can be tough sometimes as a parent. If it's fun and if your kid really wants to do it, you find a way of making that work as well. Really interesting just doing the talk just now with one of your colleagues. I know that you were in the space shed yesterday, but Ben Shaw was, we just now talking about pulsar astronomy. A little way into it, just said, let's have a show of hands. Who wants to be like Ben? Who wants a job as a pulsar astronomer? Loads of hands going up, and it's like, okay, that's cool.
That's exactly what you want to see. You've been working on the space shed and we're for 7 years now. So what are you looking forward to next?
It's a good question, Monique. You know, there's a lot of talk in the space agency at the moment about what our next mission should be. So we've had our first astronaut, Mini-John, go into low Earth orbit. We've reached that milestone. I think now it's the big question. Is it Moon or is it Mars? Or is it deeper into space? Is it a return trip? Is it a one-way trip? I think we'll probably have to consult with the membership and the agents of UNSA and see what they want to do and where they want our next space adventure to go.
Great. Well, we'll keep an eye out for it. And I am definitely going to go download that app because I love anything gamified.
It's called the Astro Science Challenge and it's free to download for both iOS, for Apple devices and for Android devices. You can do it just on a web version of it as well. If you go to astroscienceChallenge.com. It's got all of the details there that anyone might need if you're interested.
Great. Well, thank you for coming on the Jodcast and I hope you enjoy the rest of the festival.
Thanks very much. It's been a real pleasure.
Thanks for that, Monique. And now we come to the part of the show where we talk about random things that don't fit anywhere else. The odds and ends. And this really is an end.
Yeah, it is a bit. So today marks the last episode in which Charlie and I are responsible for the show. We're passing responsibility for the podcast over to Jake and Naomi here. So yeah, it's kind of the end of an era. Charlie and I were the fifth executive producer of the show. Jake and Naomi will be the sixth. So we are now, I guess, emeritus producers, as it were.
We've been going for quite a long time, actually, about 2 years and a month. So if you noticed a remarkable decline in any particular part of the podcast over that time, it may well have been due to us. Punctuality was something that we weren't strong on sometimes.
So. Very much so. Especially, I mean, you know, right now, well, we're both just going into our fourth years. And so certainly in recent months, shows have been coming out kind of quite sporadically because we've been completely unable to prioritise the Jodcast over our own work. And so, unfortunately, that means that certain shows have come out late, certain shows just haven't come out at all.
But it's the start of a new year.
Yeah,
we've got a whole new crowd of people we've just recruited.
We have.
Involved.
We've had several new sign-ups.
The transition to you guys. So yep. How do you feel about that?
Kind of scared, but also kind of excited.
Yes, really excited. Yeah.
You can do what you want.
Yeah. Our reign begins.
Yeah. Although I think you'll agree with me when I say we've got some big shoes to fill.
Yep.
I think we just took over at a good time, actually.
Yeah.
We were remarkably lucky to be taking over during the 10th anniversary. One of my favourite things that we've done, which we helped organise, was the Jodcast Live in March of 2016, which was an amazing experience.
Well, we didn't help organise it. That was just ours. We did it.
Yeah.
And it was
a lot
was
of people
awesome.
Helped yeah. as well, though.
Yeah, but it was a massive success, a full room. And yeah, I mean, that probably goes down as my favourite thing that we've actually done with the Jodcast.
Yeah, so that was the live recording at Jodrell Bank, yeah?
Yeah, March 2016. We had about 50 or 60 people turn up. Nice. We had cake.
Wow. It was just like cake.
Cake. Sally Cooper's stepmom baked us some cakes, and we had a really good celebration in front of the Lovell Telescope.
So we had some of the other Emeritus producers. They came to give interviews. Nice. So who knows, maybe at the next Jodcast Live, when that, or maybe we might be invited back.
Yeah, I mean, it's January's coming up. So January's coming up, so you guys might want to do a 12th anniversary Jodcast Live.
It's possible.
Don't do it.
Why?
It turned out to be a huge hassle to organise.
It was fantastic. It was a lot of fun, but it took months of time.
It took a long time. It was quite stressful. I think Ben, in particular, had a major role to play in making it happen. So thank you for that, Ben.
I didn't have a weekend to myself for months.
It took a very long time.
Yeah, it was. And cost quite a lot of money as well, actually, as it turned out.
So was that for like hiring a room or...?
Hiring a room, equipment...
Car park spaces.
Oh, yeah.
And actually paying our guests to come down. The biggest cost was just travel expenses
for
Jen and Chris Lintott and
other places. Yeah,
That's, you know, all in all, we spent the best part of a grand putting that on, but it was totally worth it.
Yeah, so. And we've had requests for another one, so if you're feeling up to it, I'm sure that there's an excuse.
We might just think about it.
Wait for the 50th anniversary.
But we're not quite done with organising stuff yet. We are currently writing a grant proposal to get some new equipment, but also hopefully bringing out some Jodcast t-shirts, having a couple exhibits if our grant actually gets accepted, placed at Jodrell Bank Observatory, where Ian Morrison's Night Sky can be listened to at a listening post, and people can come submit questions to ask an astronomer via Jodrell Bank itself. So
I guess we're still holding on with clenched fingernails.
For now. We're not completely gone, and we will still be appearing in episodes
for a while.
Fingers crossed. But basically, all the decision-making, all the hassle is now
it's
yours.
It's now ours.
Enjoy.
Cool. Thank you so much.
Well, I anticipate there'll be at least one point where we have to come in and say, Ben, Charlie, it's not working.
So
what
I
do we do?
Most definitely.
I often cross the room and go, Ben, it's not working. What do I do? And sometimes vice versa.
Well...
It all depends. We have our own specialities, but that's why it's good to be a two people team.
It's definitely too big for one person to handle.
Yeah, it's too big, and I think we're a good team. We'll work really well.
I think it'd be awesome.
Well, we're next to each other in one of the offices, in a professional capacity. Yes, the professional capacity. So we're a good team. So I hope you can fill your big shoes, and our run of terror begins, as I always say.
No, we wish you all the luck with it. I think you're going to enjoy it, and it's a really fulfilling thing to do.
I mean, also, thank you to all the listeners out there who've got in contact. We've been working on it for almost 3 years, and we really appreciate all the contacts you send in via email, via tweets, and via Facebook.
And the postcards.
Postcards.
I love the fact that we have so many postcards up on the wall here.
Everyone is so enthusiastic, and that makes it a really fun thing to do.
Yeah, it's fulfilling also to know that like people are out there listening to you.
And it's helped me come out of my shell a little bit as well. It's helped me become a little bit of a better presenter of science to people, I think. So it's been an amazing opportunity. I'm really grateful for actually being able to work on it. And it's not completely over.
We are still here.
We still say, Charlie, it's not working. But we'll get to learn from you. So I think it's a great opportunity for us to learn from you and to also give our best to it. No?
Make it your own.
Yeah.
Add our own like spice. Make it more flavorful.
Excellent.
Good luck.
Thank you.
Now, for our third interview, back to Monique, interviewing Grant Munro about the hidden heroes of astronomy.
So, hi, I'm here with Grant Munro, who's the manager at ESR Space.
Hi there.
Welcome to the Jodcast. Could you tell us a little bit about what you're doing at Blue Dot this weekend?
Okay, we're here this weekend to show off a bit of space hardware we have in our company that we're quite lucky to have actually, and it's actually part of the Hubble Space Telescope, and it spent 8 years in space, during which time it orbited the Earth 45,000 times. Actually, we moved premises a couple of years ago, and this piece of hardware has basically lived on our clean room roof for all of that time in a box. And it just so happened I had a chance encounter with Tim O'Brien earlier last year, and he asked if we did any outreach stuff, and I said we do a bit, but Blue Dot sounded like a great idea, and I said we'd bring this piece of hardware along, and I checked with my colleagues first, so that was all right. And we brought it along, and it was a huge success, and I think one of the nice things about Blue Dot has been that you put in, you know, a certain amount of effort, and the return you get on that, the number of people that come through the stands, just absolutely amazing. We couldn't do that with any other sort of, you know, activity in quite the same way. You know, you'd have to visit a lot of schools to achieve that same reach. So it's brilliant, it really is, and it's a great event. The range of people is just astonishing, really, from toddlers through to some pretty hardcore festival goers.
So. Yeah, no, it's definitely a very mixed crowd in a fantastic way, really. So could you tell us a little bit more about what you do at ESR?
Yeah, so my role is to design spacecraft mechanisms. So as a business, we really have a focus on overcoming tribology problems. So that's lubrication, friction and wear issues. And in the space environment, in vacuum, that's a particular challenge. So my role really is about designing mechanisms that achieve certain performance, you know, in light of that challenge. So we'll design mechanisms for often science missions. So we had a recent piece of hardware that was delivered for the SPICE instrument on Solar Orbiter. So that'll be launched, I think, early 2019 now. And that's one of 10 instruments on Solar Orbiter that's going to really enhance our understanding of the solar atmosphere physics. So as an engineer, it's not really my strength,
yeah.
but you kind of absorb some of it as you work on these programs.
Yeah.
So it's a spectrometer, so it's looking at the difference. It's amazing what they can determine from the data from these instruments in terms of sort of direction and you know, the dynamics of the atmosphere. It's amazing, really.
Yeah, no, that sounds fascinating. I bet you get to meet lots of, you know, fascinating researchers as well as part of it.
Yeah, I think more so at the start of the program, we did sort of meet a really broad range of engineers and scientists. Solar Orbiter, there's a lot of UK activity there. I think UCL have a big part to play in that.
Yeah.
And we've got some great solar physicists, I think, in this country. So, you know, I think it is a good mission for the UK, I should say. We delivered a mechanism to RAL Space down in Oxfordshire, who were the prime for the instrument. And then that was delivered, the instrument itself was delivered just a few weeks ago, really. And already it's been bolted onto the side of the spacecraft in Stevenage. So the whole spacecraft's being built in an Airbus in Stevenage.
Which is amazing, because I think I had no idea up until this weekend how much the UK was involved in the space industry.
Yes, I think it's often said that we're sort of unsung sort of heroes, but I think across science missions, and Hubble's a fantastic example. So many people think that is a NASA mission and it's purely NASA, but actually ESA have played a huge part in those huge observatories like the Hubble and like James Webb as well. I mean, if you look at James Webb, the business end of James Webb are the science instruments, of which at least two of those were wholly developed in Europe, and you know, it was a huge thing for European industry. So it's a really big project, and ESA are very much, you know, partners in that program. So I think we should always correct people when they talk about these NASA programs, because you know, we are very much a part of that, and really at the sharp end as well.
Yeah, we kind of undersell the European involvement, right?
Yes, yeah. I think that's probably true to some extent. Although I think engineers particularly fairly cautious about overselling stuff, you know. And with the type of work we do, where you're really dealing with risk, you have to be very realistic about, you know, the chances of success, and you do everything you can, but you certainly don't, you know, you don't count your chickens too early. So I think we are a little bit cautious in that respect.
No, and I guess you have to be. And one of the things that just blows my mind about anything that gets sent into space is that it pretty much has to work well the first time.
Yes. So yeah, I mean, that whole process of making sure things work whether in orbit. The Hubble's another rare exception in that it was serviceable, but the James Webb won't be. It's going so far away, and there are so many mechanisms that really have to work, and that reliability, the whole process of engineering is directed at that reliability at the end, and understanding how these things are really going to work and making sure they do. And that's really why our organisation exists, really. I mean, we've been working with ESA since 1972, obviously not personally,
yeah.
but we won a contract then to look at developing lubricants and testing them. And that was around the time of the very first European satellites. I mean, it predates ESA, in fact. It was called ESRO then.
Oh, wow.
Satellites have always had, spacecraft have always had mechanisms on them. And I think they've always been a critical part of the mission. So, we've been part of that whole process over the years of making sure that these things work on orbit and we can get them right first time. And we've been, on the whole, we've been very lucky, because when you do follow that process, things generally work. And I think there are very few instances where we've been involved in programs and they really haven't. So we've been very fortunate in that respect. You know, there have been failed launches and other problems, but I think we've got a pretty good track record, and one that we hope to maintain, of course.
Yeah, hopefully. So what are the kind of typical timescales of that kind of project? So say what you've been doing, say something you've been working recently with SPICE, for example.
Yeah, so SPICE in the end was about a four-year mission.
Mm-hmm.
Generally, missions sort of target a program of 3 years.
Mm-hmm.
You know, they do on occasion experience problems. We had our own problems.
Mm-hmm.
But again, part of the job is following that problem through to a solution. And with good engineering, hopefully you'll get there.
Yeah.
And you'll deliver something that works. And I think, thankfully, as a result of going through that program, we flushed out a few other things that we maybe could improve as well. And in the main, I think space programs often don't allow enough time for iteration and,
mm-hmm.
and development, really. It's better now. I think there was a time about 10 years ago where everyone wanted to do it leaner and quicker, but I don't think that really worked quite that way. So, three-year mission is generally sort of standard. Three-year development is generally standard, but for a big program like a Hubble or a James Webb or a BepiColombo, Colombo, which has been in the news this week, those are technologically demanding, and there's a whole program of development work that feeds into that spacecraft sort of detailed design program. So again, we get involved in that kind of thing. So maybe within the last decade, you could be working on James Webb, which would be operating at 35 Kelvin, and in the afternoon you'd be working on BepiColombo, which would be sort of 350 degrees C, and then those are kind of the two extremes that we've been working on recently. So you've got infrared, which needs the cold, and then you've got BepiColombo, which is of course going to Mercury, and things get very hot there. So.
Yeah, no, that sounds fantastically varied. So could you give us a taste of some of the kind of challenges you faced on working on one of these missions?
Yeah, so the challenges really, I mean, we do sort of get involved in programs where the lifetime, for example, is a challenge, and our lubricants have to last for the mission duration, and it might be a bearing that has to rotate at a certain speed for a certain number of years. And really, you're looking at the main aspects are the environment, so it's in vacuum. Increasingly, ground testing is a big thing. So whereas you maybe got away 10 years ago with a much shorter on ground budget, you now have to develop something to that can be used for more calibration activities. There's people don't just want to do more testing; they want to prove things. But that comes at a cost, and some lubricants which work very well in vacuum don't necessarily work very well in air or the nitrogen environment that we sometimes use. And it also places constraints on the spacecraft engineers. If you're testing a satellite, you might have to give it some kind of nitrogen purge to protect the bearings, or even test it in certain orientations sometimes. That can make a difference. That's a big constraint on the person building the satellite.
I thought you were going to say something. It's fine. And so when you're creating these tests on Earth, obviously you can create a near vacuum and you can approximate the temperatures, but you can't create zero G. Is that something you have to take into account, and does it impact the performance of anything? I'm not sure how it would, but I just thought I'd ask.
Yeah, zero G, I've actually been asked that quite a lot this week, whether we do any tests on the ISS or on a zero G plane or anything. It's quite an easily quantifiable effect. So in some cases we can make allowances for perhaps a little bit of extra load on a bearing, for example, that we're testing. In general, it's not something we do, but there are obviously uncertainties related to it. So, and particularly with liquid lubricants, on occasion we use greases and oils, and obviously those, if they're sitting for a long time in vacuum on Earth, you know, there's a gravitational effect to how those will migrate within the hardware. So keeping your oil in the right place in the bearing is a big challenge, and obviously gravity has an influence in that, but it's generally not something we've really had to focus too much on. But there's certainly areas and questions that could be answered, and I think it's probably not the top priority right now, but there are certainly areas where it could be.
And what is the top priority?
I think on the solid lubrication side, we're looking to improve that balance between testing in vacuum and testing in air. I think there's very much a customer demand for that, and it influences much more of the higher volume commercial stuff. I think with the real extremes of missions duration, you know, they tend to be one-off science missions, and therefore there's not the demand in the industry for that. So, and ultimately it's that demand that pays the bills, really. And the money has to come from somewhere, and, you know, it has to be a big problem to spend that kind of money on solving it, really. And then that's the reality of what we do sometimes. It's, you know, gotta.
I was going to say, so what other industries does your work apply to?
Well, we really can add a lot to any vacuum industry, really. Mm-hmm. You know, we're quite unique in that we've got a huge body of test data from 45 years. Probably one of our most successful space spin-outs has been into the medical industry. So we provide a huge amount of bearing lubricated lubrication products to the medical industry. So they go into MRI scanners and things. So if you've been in an MRI scanner at any time, mm-hmm. The chances are, more likely than not, they've got a bearing with our lubrication in. And originally the problem there was that the bearings were awfully noisy. Mm-hmm. They're noisy places at the best of times, but
yes.
I think they were exceptionally noisy before we got involved. Mm-hmm. And we developed a coating based on silver, so a very thin film of silver, less than a micron thick. And that's that coating is what provides the reliable sort of smooth rotation of those bearings. It's still not in general terms that smooth, but it's certainly better than what they had.
Ah, so next time I have an MRI scan, I'll be keeping that in mind. Yeah.
I bought my dog in the morning, and I pass one every day actually at the local hospital. So I think about that every time I see him.
Well, no, but that's great to see that it's kind of the same science and engineering you're putting through. Like, I mean, obviously the situation is very different, and there's, you know, slightly different problems you have to think about. But that's fantastic to see the applicability of it.
Yeah. I mean, there are other industries. I mean, increasingly we're getting a little bit involved in fusion energy. So people are interested in that. I mean, these are big long-term programs, and there's so many material developments that are required. But in terms of the remote handling there, you know, you have to operate this fusion reactor for maybe 20 years. And at the end of it, you want to decommission it robotically. And you want to know that a screw is going to come out. And that, again, that's a lubrication problem, really. So we're looking at our lubricants for that purpose as well.
And that's really long term. Like, I never stop and think that everyone has to think about this before they start.
Yeah, and I think that's the... That's the beauty of what we do, actually. And probably the best bit for me on working on these big programs is just the all the people that come together with their skills, and after, you know, what is essentially a big bun fight, you come out at the end with something that's really amazing. And then, you know, I think that's the challenge for me, just bringing that whole systems engineering together to create something that's probably much better than you thought you could achieve at the start. So there's a bit of give and take involved. But it's, you know, it's that collaboration, I think, that's probably the most rewarding part. That and launching a spacecraft and seeing those images come back a few years later. That's always nice.
That is, yeah, pretty incredible. So how did you even get into this?
For me personally, I probably wasn't one of those people that grew up really thinking that's what I want to do.
Yeah.
At university, I developed an interest in optics, and then also an interest in sort of dynamic testing, vibration, and things like that. And I think just those interests came together in a way that was just really lent itself to developing spacecraft instruments. So,
yeah.
So I went to work at the Rutherford Appleton Laboratory in Oxfordshire after I graduated. And after spending time there, which was really fascinating, I worked on some great projects. I think there was an element of lots of big projects and not too many people to work on them. So you got sort of, you know, dropped headfirst into some pretty amazing things. Within a few weeks of being there, I was working on Beagle. Which is nice, and it launched very quickly afterwards. I mean, it's quite rare for anybody, I think, to get involved as a graduate on something that essentially flies so quickly afterwards. And then within 18 months, it landed on Mars. And as we know now, it has survived. So that was obviously a long wait to find that out. So that was great. And then after several years of working there, I saw this opportunity came up in Warrington, and so that was working on spacecraft mechanisms, and I think that was quite attractive to me. You might have guessed that I'm originally from the north, so there's a bit of sort of thinking about that, and so that sort of influenced my decision. I came up and really haven't looked back. It's mechanism engineering is, you know, some critical stuff there. It's the sharp end. There's nowhere to hide. You know, you can't blag your way out of the problems we have. So I quite like that. You know, it sorts out the, I think it really challenges your engineering skills. And you have to be right. You can't, it's not like being a politician. You can't win the argument and be wrong. You have to use your judgment, win the argument, and be right. And your reputation depends on it. And I'm really lucky to work with a bunch of really committed, experienced people who, you know, have really devoted a lot of time to understanding this. And it's quite nice to be part of a team like that. And I think overall, you know, the space industry is full of people like that. So anyone thinking, you know, about working in engineering, you know, it. There are a lot of committed people that are really focused on, you know, doing the job and doing the right thing, and the things that come out from it are really, you know, really good. You know, whether it's looking at climate change, whether it's planetary exploration, science, you know, there's some really great benefits to society from doing this. Not, you know, that helps. It helps you sleep at night.
I would say, in my opinion, engineers are the unsung heroes of science, genuinely, because all of those fantastic pictures we see from the Hubble and those telescopes wouldn't be there without you.
Yeah, I think that's certainly true. I think we could always do more to celebrate our successes. I think that's probably true. Often those successes come a long time after doing the work, and we're already onto the new thing that interests us. Engineers are probably some of the worst people for that, and myself included, probably. I think there's it's very rewarding, though, and I think a lot of people are very sort of self-satisfied, and, you know, it's quite a rewarding career. But you're right, we have to sell it to the next generation, don't we? Otherwise, you know, I think we all lose out.
Yeah, well, it's been great to speak to you, and I had a fantastic insight into what you do. Thank you very much.
Thank you very much.
Thanks for that, Monique. And for our final interview, we've got something a little bit different. It was another interview that took place at Blue Dot. Monique interviewed the Wellcome Centre for Mitochondrial Research and University of Newcastle's Amy Vincent about mitochondrial disorders. And at the end of September, it was Mitochondrial Awareness Week. And we received a postcard, which you might have seen that we tweeted, which is from Jed Buttress, who was an artist who was collaborating with these guys at Blue Dot and making ink prints and posting them to people during the week. And we received one quite by surprise via the post on that week. I wasn't expecting it. I imagine that this happened during the interview and Monique got it organised as a nice surprise for us. So if any of the listeners were at Blue Dot, they might have got some of these as well. But it's very nice. It's a prostate mitochondria, which is actually prettier than it sounds. So
you certainly wouldn't guess that what it was by looking at it. It just looked like modern art.
Yeah. Mm.
So
it's like polka dot.
Yeah.
With a bird in it. Yeah, it looks like a bird.
It's like one of those...
Yeah, it does.
Yeah, I see it now. Yeah.
It's a bit like an eye test, I think. Yeah. So Amy Vincent gave us a brief biology lesson, introduced us to these diseases and the relevance of mitochondrial research to dementia. So take a listen.
Hi, I'm here with Amy Vincent from the Wellcome Centre for Mitochondrial Research in Newcastle University. Welcome to the Jodcast.
Hi, nice to meet you.
Yeah, I hope you're enjoying the festival.
I am, yeah, it's really good.
Mm-hmm. So what are you doing here at Blue Dot?
So we're here mainly to raise awareness of mitochondrial disease, but we've got a collaboration with an artist called Jed that's also based at Newcastle. So what we're trying to do is kind of translate our images from the lab into nice artwork. So he's generated some wood blocks based on our images and he's printing postcards to send out to people.
Oh, that's very cool. So what are mitochondria?
So mitochondria are essentially the batteries of the cell. So they make all the energy that all the cells in your body need. So if you have a problem with the mitochondria, it's the tissues that require the most energy that start to have problems with working, like the brain and the muscle and the heart as well.
And are mitochondrial diseases things that affect lots of people?
So mitochondrial diseases are actually quite rare, particularly, so it's sort of an umbrella term. You have lots of different conditions that come under mitochondrial diseases, which each of them are very rare. But actually, when you put them all together, it does start to make up quite a large group of people. And the other thing is that we have a lot of research that's going on that are into other diseases that you have mitochondrial dysfunction associated with. So things like Parkinson's disease, Alzheimer's, MS. And actually, you get some dysfunction when you're just through general healthy aging. So sort of 70 and 80 year olds will have a degree of mitochondrial dysfunction just based on the aging process.
So the stuff you're looking into, it applies to people who suffer from these diseases, but also the wider population.
Yeah, absolutely. And obviously, we see with Parkinson's and Alzheimer's disease, because you see mitochondrial dysfunction in these, that's really important with our aging population, because we need to understand what's happening to these people who are getting things like dementia and stuff like that, to be able to, you know, treat people and have healthier, longer lives.
And what do we know so far about what might be the causes for stuff like this?
So at the moment, it's not very well characterised. So we know to what extent we get changes in the mitochondria with things like Parkinson's disease, but we don't really have a full grasp on whether it's the Parkinson's disease that's affecting the mitochondria or vice versa. So how much is the mitochondrial dysfunction contributing to Parkinson's disease and Alzheimer's disease? Of that, we're not quite sure yet.
I guess it's still a work in progress.
It is. It's a lot of work going on and a lot of work left to go.
That's always good for scientists. So what do you specifically work on?
So I actually work on muscle. So what I aim to do is, within the mitochondria, they have their own DNA, and you have a particular group of conditions where mutations arise in them. And as they arise, because the mitochondrial DNA is present in so many copies, they could arise in just one mitochondrial DNA. Over the lifespan, they accumulate to a point where it could be like 75% of the mitochondrial DNA that's mutated. And what I'm trying to do is understand how that process happens in muscle, in the hope that because the accumulation is what causes the dysfunction of the tissue, that we can intervene and try and slow that accumulation.
And have you got any ideas for how you might do that, or is it at the very early stage?
So I wouldn't say it's at the early stage. It's something that people have been working on for decades now, and it's a very difficult problem to tackle, to understand even part of the story of what's happening. So at the moment, we've got some ideas of what pathways within the cell we can target and how we might treat them, but it's still quite a way of being a potential treatment, and there's a lot of work left to go.
So what's your day-to-day work like? You know, in the lab? I have no idea. What are you doing in your field?
So my day-to-day is actually quite variable. So some days I can have a day where, yeah, I'm in the lab, I'll maybe do some staining of some muscle tissue, pop that on the microscope and have a look at it. But other days I'll have days that are sort of analysing the data that I've got or analysing images that I've taken. Lots of writing to sort of draw in other areas of research and understand my results. It's quite variable. It's really nice to have a bit of a mix.
What for you is the thing you're most looking forward to in your field?
I would say the thing I'm most looking forward to actually is that we recently had three-parent IVF go through a parliamentary debate and get legalised within the UK. So our centre applied in November to be a centre that was able to do this, and we're in the process of sort of setting this up and being able to collect donor eggs and start this IVF process for some of the patients. And I think it would just be so rewarding to see these first children born that are disease-free from parents who would have passed on mitochondrial disease. So that's what I'm looking forward to.
Yeah, no, that's lovely. And actually, because I've heard of that process, but I had no idea what it was for. So that's really good to hear about the impact and how it's actually going to happen. Great. Well, thank you for talking to us on the Drugcast.
That's okay.
And I hope you enjoy the rest of the festival.
Thank you. You too.
Thanks for that, Monique. And now on to the rest of the feedback. And so myself and Naomi have had our first postcard this month in our capacity as quote-unquote chief Jodcasters. So it is from Camino de Santiago, which is north to northwest Spain, as I'll just read what we've got. Hola! While binge listening to your fabulous podcast and after a hard day cycling the Camino, I thought I'd send you a postcard. Keep up the great work. Buen Camino from Ellen.
Excellent. Thank you, Ellen. What's on the front?
Ellen.
I had a little look on Wikipedia, and this is apparently St. James.
Oh.
The mythology says that he rests at the top of the Camino. This is a monastery up in the northwest of Spain.
Well, that's nice. Interesting.
Let me have a look.
He looks really confused.
Like he's tired.
Yeah.
Well, to be fair, if he's a saint, you've got a lot of weight on your shoulders.
Yeah, the sins of the world.
Yeah, I guess he's got many pressing matters at hand.
Yeah.
Cool. Excellent. There's been no feedback from Facebook, Twitter or Flickr, and we also have no emails recently except one today that came just to tell us our RSS feed wasn't working, but we fixed that now, so hopefully all is well. And if you want to get in touch, you can do so via the website at www.jodcast.net,
on Twitter at twitter.com/jodcast,
on Facebook at facebook.com/jodcast,
on YouTube at youtube.com/jodcast,
on Flickr at flickr.com/groups/jodcast.
And don't forget that you can send us post. The address is on the website.
Thanks to Amy Vincent, Beth Rogers, John Spooner and Grant Munro for the interviews. The editors were George Bendo, Andrea Degaru, Monique Henson, Tom Scragg and Charlie Walker. The producers were Benjamin Shaw and Charlie Walker. Until next time,
Join on!